As a pastor, you never forget the first wedding you perform. There might be dozens that come after the first, but you never forget the first. The first wedding I performed was an evening event. The couple was lovely and very gracious, a young couple. They knew it was my first wedding, but they were very magnanimous about it all, and yet still I was quite nervous. In the weeks leading up, I had carefully prepared the ceremony itself, put together a short meditation that I thought would be meaningful, and I rehearsed the event multiple times. It was the last thing I wanted to do was to mess up this big day on this couple my first time through. So I prepared really well in advance. By the day of, I was more than ready. But still, in the moments leading up to the event, I was so nervous. I was shuddering there like a scared dog. Well, as the ceremony got underway, as you can imagine, I soon found my groove. Things began to unfold just as we had prepared them and just as we had rehearsed. The processional went off without a hitch. The people were in their places. My opening remarks went off without much of a nervous waver in my voice. Everything was just moving along perfectly. And then just as I was finding my stride, you know, kind of loosening up a little, as I worked my way into this meditation I prepared, it happened. First, I noticed it in the groom's eyes, and then in the bride's. They were no longer looking at me, but just off my right shoulder. Still, pressing ahead with my words, I glanced just a little bit with my peripheral to try and get a glimpse of what it was that they were looking at. And as I did so, I noticed movement. And it was enough movement to kind of warrant a full look. So I looked away from my notes, and as I did so, I couldn't believe what I was looking at. One of the groomsmen was swaying and twisting like a limp reed in the wind, and all the rest of the groomsmen were just standing there, almost like in shock, not sure what to do. Well, clearly the swaying man was doing everything he could do to avoid passing out, but his attempts were quickly being overrun by the forces of nature that were at work in his own body. And so in a little bit of shock myself, I yelled out to these motionless groomsmen, "Guys, grab him, he's going down." Well, jumping to his aid, they took him by the shoulders just in time for him to collapse into them. And then, limp in their arms, they carried him over to the front pew of the church where they laid him out on the pew, and not soon after, he kind of came to. Well, the groomsman spent the rest of the ceremony sprawled out on his back at the front of the church while we tried to carry on with the rest of the event as though nothing had happened, but clearly something had happened. Well, the one nice thing about the day, there was many nice things about the day, but the one nice thing about the day was that I knew that after that, there was little that could happen at a wedding that would faze me. Well, in John 2, we discover that Jesus is at a wedding. It's a coming out party for him, sort of sorts. It was here that Jesus was going to perform his first miracle as recorded in the Gospel of John. It seems, though, that something has happened at the wedding in Cana near the Galilee that also promises to ruin the event. And as we'll read, Jesus has been called, much like the groomsmen, to step in and save the event from disaster. So let's read the story, probably familiar to many of you, found in chapter 2, verses 1 to 11. And then we'll dig into it from there, beginning in verse 1. On the third day, a wedding took place in Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Dear woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My time has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you to do." Nearby stood 6 stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw out some and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though, and the servants that had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink." but you have saved the best till now. This, the first of the miraculous signs Jesus performed at Cana in Galilee. He thus revealed his glory, and his disciples put their faith in him. Just a great story, a great opening story that John's Gospel begins with, starting out the wedding. Before we dig into the story, I want us just to jump back a little bit to the end of chapter 1, which is what we dealt with in the last podcast. As you may recall, toward the end of John 1, we encounter this character named Nathanael. At the end of the Gospel in John chapter 21, verse 2, we read that this Nathanael, incidentally, who in the other Gospel is called Bartholomew and is one of the disciples of Jesus, we read that Nathanael comes from the town of Cana. So where the event is taking place is his hometown. Well, in John chapter 1, as we meet him, this Canaanite is asking a skeptical question of Jesus that he has yet to make. He asks, can anything good come from Nazareth? See, Nazareth was a small kind of podunk town near the Galilee. It didn't appear much on the map. There was maybe a couple of hundred people that lived in it in Jesus' day. And so Nathanael was really just kind of referencing a common sentiment about the place called Nazareth. You know, it's Nazareth. Really, Nazareth? You're telling me about Jesus as they were at the end of John 1, but can anything really great come out of Nazareth? However, as we see, the scene here in the story we're reading now, just a couple of verses later, shifts over to Cana, Nathanael's hometown, and we see here now it's a little subtle play on words that John is creating by recording the statement that he does in the end of John 1. In John 1, you see Nathanael from Cana asks if anything good can come from Nazareth. And in John 2, the scene now in Cana, we see the answer. Can anything good come from Nazareth? Only Jesus. Only the great King of Israel. And he's making his first appearance. He's coming out party, so to speak. Nathanael, in your hometown. And if you listen really closely in behind, it's almost as if you can hear the heavenly booyah that echoes between the lines as we read along. Nathanael, can anything good come from Nazareth? Why don't we just show you in your own hometown? It's awesome. Well, as you may know, ancient Near Eastern weddings were these grand affairs. The whole town would come to celebrate the betrothal of some of their own. The events would often last for a whole week, filled with feasting and dancing and, yes, drinking, lots of drinking. And from the story itself, we pick up a couple of things about the drinking that were obviously common in the day. First thing is that it would have been deeply embarrassing for the host of the wedding, the bridegroom himself, to run out of drink. And secondly, because it would be a great expense, it was common for the host to serve the best drink first, until the guest's palate were not so acute for obvious reasons, at which time the cheaper wine would then come out and begin to be served. Well, it seems that at the wedding Jesus attended with his friends here, that the great embarrassment had befallen the host. And somehow we also discover that Mary, the mother of Jesus, has learned about the pending catastrophe. And hearing about the event, and obviously aware by this point, at least to some degree, of her son's unique abilities, she kind of thrusts him into the mix, even though at first he says, it's not my time. No, mother, dear woman, why are you doing this? And I think it's kind of interesting when you read the story how even the Son of God here, the Messiah himself, the great King of Israel, was under the thumb of his mother at this point. It's just this, I think, this great subtle little nod to Jesus' humanness, to his very real earthliness. Okay, Mom, I guess so. Well, on the one hand, the story is just a beautiful opening picture of Jesus' great heart of compassion. Friends of his are in need. He and his disciples have been invited to the wedding, and the need isn't life-threatening or deeply profound, but in that society, it was a real need. You know, shame was about to befall them unless something were to happen, and so to protect his friends from their embarrassment, Jesus steps in and kindly, in a miraculous way, remedies the situation, making for the wedding the very best wine. And so in the end, not only would the host be spared of the shame, but actually he would be praised for saving the best wine till the very end. And as I say, on the one hand, the story is just simply a beautiful opening picture of Jesus' ministry. John was telling us here in this beautiful opening picture that he was a man of great care and great compassion for people in all the situations of life that they would find them in. And you know, if we left it at just that interpretation, which I'm sure many of you have heard taught before, we'd be spot on. All of this is true of the story. But the thing is that it's not the only truth that the story is wanting to reveal to us. There's another side of the story. And the clue that we're given to this is found in verse 11. Here John tells us that Jesus' miracle at the wedding was a sign. The first sign that he would perform. If you go back a little ways and think back a little ways, as we saw in one of the opening podcasts dealing with the context of John, the opening section of John's Gospels, chapter 1 to chapter 12, is built around signs. There's 7 signs to be exact, and the first few happen in connection with the sacred institutions or the sacred things of Israel, and the next few happen in connection with sacred festivals or the sacred feasts of Israel. The term signs is a really important term. While the signs in the gospel are always miraculous, the term itself is not necessarily synonymous with miraculous. It actually means something even more than a miracle. What it actually means is a miraculous action or a profound action which is intending to point to something deeper, something it's wanting to reveal something more. And in John's Gospel, the 7 signs are actions performed by Jesus then, which are intended to point to a deeper reality about him. Remember, the Gospel is there to expose for us Jesus. And so these 7 signs are included to reveal Jesus even more. And always this deeper reality is connected to what the sign is connected to, these sacred institutions or festivals. So in some ways, when you look at the sign that Jesus performs or the miracle that he performs, and then you look at what the sacred institution is or what the sacred festival is, when you combine these things together, it's almost like it unlocks something really wonderful about Jesus. And I think you'll see that over the course of the podcast as they carry on. You'll probably see that today, even here. So the question then we need to ask here is, what does this first sign reveal to us about Jesus? And to get the answer, we like detectives just kind of need to break the story apart a little bit and ask a few simple basic questions of the story. It's always what we do of the scriptures when we read it. We just ask good questions of it. And so the first question maybe that we would want to ask is, well, where does the story take place? It's obvious, but let's think about that for a second. It takes place at a wedding. That's interesting, right? Because if you've ever read the Bible before, you know that this is an interesting setting for this first kind of miracle, this coming out party for Jesus. See, from beginning to end, wedding is used as a metaphor numerous times in the scriptures. And one of the key ways it's used is found in Hosea chapter 2. And in Hosea 2, the wedding is used as an image for the coming of the Messiah. Remember, the Messiah was the anointed king of Israel, the one that all the prophets told Israel to expect, the one that was coming to liberate the world from sin and to establish the kingdom of God and the kingdom of righteousness and shalom in the world, of peace in the world. And so the picture is simple that this gives, the metaphor of the wedding is simple. From Isaiah 2, it's like that one day the Messiah will come and he will gather his people as a groom gathers a bride to himself. Okay, so with that little bit of preliminary thinking then, don't you think it's kind of interesting that Jesus now would choose to do his very first action, his first miracle, at a wedding? Now what might he have been saying? Remember, John's already told us it's a sign pointing to a deeper reality about him. Could it have been that Jesus was giving it kind of initial prompt for those that had eyes to see that Maybe he was the one they were looking for, the one that Hosea had talked about. He was the groom that Israel had been longing for, who was now coming to gather his bride to himself. Now, of course, it's just the first sign, and it wasn't overly blatant, but the initial hints were coming, and later they would get stronger and stronger. You'll see this as we go along, as each of these signs are performed. It's like the evidence just continues to compound as to what Jesus is saying, and in nearly every one he's trying to announce to people, to reveal to people, the Messiah has come, I'm here. But for now, the seed here was just being planted. It's a wedding. It's a wedding. And to the astute Jewish reader, the bells would have been going off. And maybe they should be for us as well. What is Jesus saying? Is he the one that Hosea spoke of? But it's not all. When we read on, we see that in order to perform his sign, Jesus, you see, uses 6 ceremonial jars. These are the sacred articles, the sacred institutions that this sign is connected to. And the jars were central to Jewish worship. They were what they used to fill up with water to cleanse themselves, ceremonially kind of washing away sin, or symbolically washing away sin prior to worship. But the telling detail of the story is that the jars were sitting there empty. That their ability to cleanse is gone. They needed now to be filled up with water. They contained no water at the time. There was nothing of usefulness in them. There was nothing of worth in them. Now we know those jars are central to the story, but the next question we ask is, well, what might it mean that they're empty? And was this part of another part of the sign? Was it saying something? What was the Jewish worship? Was it empty now? Had it somehow over time, has it somehow lost its ability to cleanse? Did it need to be refilled with something new? Did maybe new wine? So what does Jesus do? Yeah, he takes these empty jars and he fills them up with something new. And not water this time, at least not eventually. It's something even better. What the jars held before was needed, but now they're going to hold something else altogether. And the ceremonial jars are filled with wine. And it's not just any wine, it's the best wine. The best wine has been saved till the end, is the comment we hear. And it's not just a little bit of wine. No, it's huge amounts of wine. When you do the math, the jars contain anywhere from 120 to 180 gallons of wine. And so suddenly, the wedding and the guests and these jars have become overwhelmed with enormous amounts of wine. These things which were empty, this wedding now which was empty, now is overflowing with wine because Jesus has arrived into the scene. Now, why I'm getting excited about that is to get the full scope of that, we need to see one thing. Wine was another key metaphor or word picture in the Old Testament, and it symbolized at least a couple of things. First of all, is that wine was a sign of God's blessing. When the Old Testament spoke of wine in the metaphorical sense, it usually was a mark that God was pouring himself out in a lavish way on his people. And secondly, and here back to the Messiah thing again, wine was also often used as a symbol of blessing for the day of the Messiah. When the Messiah came, when he came to liberate the world, it would be like wine, beautiful wine being poured out on the people. Listen to what Amos says in chapter 9. He says in verse 11, "In that day I will restore David's fallen tent." In other words, I'll restore the line of David, which we know the Messiah is coming from. "I will repair its broken pieces. I'll restore its ruins and build it as it used to be. The days are coming, declares the Lord, when the reaper will be overtaken by the plowman and the planter by the one treading grapes. New wine will drip from the mountains and flow from all the hills." So much wine is pouring from the mountains. I will bring back my exiled people to Israel. They will rebuild the ruined cities and live in them. They will plant vineyards and drink their wine. They will make gardens and eat their fruit. So here's Jesus, and he's at a wedding. And he takes these jars, jars which were key to Israel, but jars which were now empty, and he fills them up with wine, so much wine that it's flowing down from the mountains, and it's the best wine. The empty jars are now being filled up with something better. Something new has come now. Something new has come to Israel. It's the very best. So what does the sign mean? Well, in case you're lost still, let's knit it together. It's the first revelation of who he is. It's telling us a deeper reality about him. By performing the sign at the wedding, using empty ceremonial jars and filling them with wine, for all those with ears to hear and with eyes to see, Jesus was telling them. He's telling us, he's given us a hint. Promised time had now come. The wedding of the Messiah was now happening. The Messiah was coming for his bride. The day of the flowing had come. The jars of Israel, yeah, they had run empty, but now they were being filled up. They were being fulfilled with something new. And it was the best. It was better even than what was before. And it was all happening through and by and in and around Jesus. It was all about him. He was the bridegroom at the wedding. He was the one that was bringing wine. The day of wine was upon them. The Messiah was upon them. And he was the best. Hebrews 1:1 would later say, "In the past, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at many times and in many ways. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he has appointed heir of all things, and through whom also he made the universe. In the last days, he did one thing, but now the best has been saved for the last." New wine. It's come. So what do we do with Jesus? What do we do with the great news? I'd suggest at least one thing, maybe only one thing to start with. And the instruction actually comes from what Mary says to the servants in the story. It's the most important instruction in the entire scriptures, and it's given to us right here in this opening story of Jesus. You see, they've run out of wine. Mary finds out about it. She goes to Jesus. Jesus says, "It's not my time." And then she right away goes over to the servants. And she says to the servants, "Hey guys, you see that man over there? You go and do whatever he tells you to do. The Messiah has come. The day of new wine is here. It's the best wine. And the one who brought it, whatever he tells you to do, you do it."